What's up and good morning, guys. Welcome back to the Golden Nuggets podcast. My name is Dr. CJ De Palma, and I'm with my partner, Dr. Joe Camerato. And today we have a very special guest, Mr. John Flagg. Oh, ha.
Yeah. Woo.
John comes to us from, you know what? I'll let John introduce himself because he's going to do it way better than me.
Oh man, where do I start? So I'm the owner operator of Rebuild Stronger, a powerlifting, strongman, and weightlifting coaching platform that's completely online. I'm also the head instructor for a clinical athlete powerlifting coaching certification that is got some pretty cool announcements for this coming year in the seminar schedule. I'm also the other head coach for the Honey Badger Project, which is a health entrepreneur coaching and mentorship service. So keep myself plenty busy, and I'm very excited to be on here talking to you guys. CJ, I've known you for years. Joe, we've done a lot of work together with Level Up Mentorship, so it's fun to be on.
Yeah, well, hey, thanks for coming on. We're super excited to have you. You do lots of things and a lot more than me and Joe do. We think we're busy, but then we talk to people like you and well, Joe doesn't think he's busy. I think I'm busy. And then we talk to people like you and you're like, man, we kind of suck. Let's do a little more. And so it's definitely always good to see someone, especially not a clinician, which is super cool that you're so integrated in all of this. Or not a physical therapist. Sorry, yeah. We'll be specific with that.
Athletic trainer.
So integrated into the rehab world and influencing a lot of people that a lot of people believe that you can't do without a PT degree. I definitely am guilty of that. So let's just give us a little bit of background on like your athletic training and kind of how you got to where you are. Why athletic training? How'd you get there? How did you get into this, like the rehab online space?
So I picked athletic training when I was just starting in undergrad. There's a lot of contention between the two professions in AT and PT, especially because really the base of education is very, very similar. It's just they end up taking two different paths. So with physical therapy, there's the neuro component, ortho component. It's all that stuff. And with athletic training, and it's also written in our bylaws, we only really are supposed to work with the active population, which is really nebulous. It's like one of these, what does that really mean when we start talking about that legally? But you know, I got sucked into it because I had an athletic trainer in high school that basically patched me together for 4 years and allowed me to compete at a high level. So his influence kind of influenced me to do the same thing. So went to Salisbury University. I got my degree there. Absolutely loved it. Working with their sports teams, managing injury, you know, doing a lot of lifting. I had a bunch of friends that like our schedule was basically wake up in the morning, go do morning treatments. We had 6 a.m. treatments. So we were practically in the athletic training room every single day doing treatments and rehab and stuff for 4 years. We would do that. We'd go to class till about nine. Till about noon. We'd grab a quick lunch. We'd study for a little bit. We'd go back to class. By 3 o'clock, we're in the treatment room for pre-practice treatments. You go out and stand out and practice. You come back in about 6 o'clock. You do post-practice treatments. You practice a little bit more. Then you go hit the gym. You go lift. And you go home and eat and go back to sleep. And you do it all 6 days a week. So that was my undergrad college career. And one of the things that solidified just really kind of the way that I practice was my athletes at Salisbury who took better care of themselves outside of the gym seemed to not need me as much. When I took that to grad school at Penn State and started working with the baseball, men's and women's soccer team and dabbling a little bit in other teams where people needed help, I saw the same thing. And I just started to build this philosophy where it was like, okay, well, if my athlete is bigger, faster, and stronger than you, then they're probably going to hurt you more than they hurt them. And my second year of grad school, I was really fortunate. I worked with this kid. He was our starting forward. He's a striker. He ended up playing for years in MLS, but he was an absolute freak. like would bike 10 miles to school and then work out and then do soccer practice. And then like, you guys know what a bod pod is?
No.
It's a like an pod? Egg. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It's like an egg where you can do body fat measurements. The kid didn't even register in the machine. Like, he was just so ripped. And he looks at me, he's like, you know, I've got like 2 hours in the middle of the day. What do you want to do? So what do you mean? What do you want to do? He's like, you're at the gym all the time. Let's start working out together. That turned into, cause soccer's a spring sport for, or fall sport for the season. I ended up by the end of the year having pretty much the entire team in these like middle afternoon workouts, and our injury rate went straight down. I mean, we just started playing around with stuff, running, lifting. I had 2 hours of basically the entire team, and we just started crushing it. And that's where I graduated from school, went to a PT clinic, and that's kind of where all the other stuff started and how I kind of inserted myself into physical therapy. Because, I mean, I'm still a licensed healthcare provider. It's just I'm limited in regards to, like, direct access to insurance, and I can't charge insurance, so I have to charge cash if I'm going to give services. And I need a, you know, supervising physician if I want to do certain things, and that's all well and good. But if it's the athletic population and they're paying me cash, then I'm in a pretty good spot. So went, started working with a clinic in high school. After the first year, we got outbid for the contract. Yeah.
Woohoo.
So every athletic trainer on staff got let go except for me. So I'm sitting there. I just bought a house. I had just gotten engaged. And our boss came in the middle of the summer, and he's like, yeah, we don't have the contract anymore, so I have no way to pay any of you. So I walked up to him after the meeting, and I was like, hey, man. And he goes, I know you're in a bad spot. I was like, yeah, I'm in a shitty spot. This is like the worst ever. I have a mortgage now all of a sudden. I don't have rent. So he's going to keep you on, but we're going to have to figure something out because, like, I can't pay you to just be a fancy tech. So, okay. So from that point forward, I had to, like, earn my keep in a PT clinic, trying to find non-traditional ways to make myself valuable. And did that for 10 years. And for the first five, it was just grinding, kind of, you know, being right next to the PTs, helping with exercise prescription or whatever. Meanwhile, I'm coaching powerlifting and weightlifting and doing all the stuff that I love to do. And all that just started to spill together until Clinical Athlete was started with Quinn. And, you know, he's somebody that I had always talked to quite a bit online. And this is where the power of the internet just becomes really ridiculous. We hooked up. I got into the network. It absolutely checked off every single one of my biases, but it also challenged the hell out of me. Like, I was still at that time, and I think we've all been here before. I got out of school, and I was like, well, I'm going to give it a try. Like, I'll give Graston a try. Not to not – like, if you're a Graston practitioner, I'm not crushing you right now. But, like, it was one of those things. I tried everything. And then I got demolished by Derek Miles and Michael Ray and those guys in the forum. And it's like, oh, maybe I should think about stuff before I just start trying it out. And
for the club.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I used to get my popcorn out to watch that.
I think we all kind of did. You ask a simple question. Jake Manley and I always talk about how we bonded over the fact that we both asked about body tempering in the same week on the forum, and they're two separate threads. And Mike literally just like copy and pasted this super long post to both of them. And I was like, oh, God. You couldn't even like, oh, it was rough. So,
yeah, I feel you there.
Yeah. And that's ended up, you know, being a big catalyst for my career. And from there, it was just, okay, how do I continue to do this? I left the clinic about a year ago at this point, and I just started taking everything online. The catalyst for going online is I had a weightlifter who left the gym that I was coaching people out of. She moved down to Texas. And she was like, well, what can we do? I don't want to find somebody down there. She lives in like the middle of nowhere. I was like, well, I could try coaching you online and see how that works. And from there, it's what it is now, which is about 50 athletes and
money,
you know, people in India and Finland. And nice. I love it. It's great. It is definitely more Frank and I talk about this all the time. It's definitely more strength and conditioning based than what I think a lot of people think of, like telehealth. So yeah, there's a benefit there, but the digital space is exploding. So it is pretty cool to see.
Yeah. And we're both happy to be part of the Honey Badger, trying to, at least myself, trying to figure out how to go online. And I know that CJ already has been online for a number of years now. And so I'm happy to be working with him as well, but it is, does represent its own unique challenges of like, you know, how do you communicate well? How do you communicate your intonations over messaging when you're working with an athlete who you don't usually video chat with, or who you don't go on phone calls with? And how do you communicate well and build that, you know, therapeutic alliance without being in person? It's definitely been challenging.
Yeah.
It is a challenge, but I will say, this is something we chatted a little bit about with Natasha Wilch that did our live training this past week. COVID was tough for a lot of people. What's that?
I said, which we missed. That's all right. Oh, we'll get to it.
Recording's there. It's great. She did an awesome job. But with that, COVID was tough on a lot of people for sure. But it also made people go, well, you know, I don't want physical therapy online. I don't want coaching online. And all of a sudden it's like, well, you have to, if you want anything, you have to go online. And now all of a sudden people tried it and they're like, this is pretty cool. Like, I don't have to leave my house. I still feel just as good. I get, you know, in some instances, depending on your environment, you get more feedback, more care. You know, there's physical therapy mills out there where you got two people coming in every 15 minutes. Now, none of us work in that environment.
Sure.
But if you're a patient that's used to being able to only talk to your PT for 5 minutes, and now all of a sudden you get 20, 25, 30, mm-hmm. you're loving it.
Yeah. Yeah. I would say I've been kind of like groveling at the side of all of this, like, online success people are having, because, you know, we've just gotten so much flack over the years of like treating people online and not touching them and things like that. And I'm like, you know, I don't know what to tell you. Like, it's, you know, the success rates are there. And I've always been very fortunate to have a very specific, like, patient demographic that like comes through my door, through my funnel. So like success rates and outcomes, like, I think they're fluffed, right? So I don't think it's very fair, but you know, even the ones that like might not fit the mold, you know, we've had a lot of success and a lot of people, you know, are seeing those kind of things with this new like telehealth. And I was talking to a physician the other day, and she's maybe a GE gastroenterologist, possibly. I can't remember. She's an athlete of mine, or was going to be an athlete of mine, but anyways. And she was like, I love this. She was like, I have, you know, she sees a lot of older population. And I think like, it's the best thing. You have like to get dependent 80-year-old who's non-mobile to the hospital for a 5-minute checkup with their physician is insane. The amount of cost, like, you know, you have Z Trip or like, you know, whatever, it's like Move America that has to like come out, you know, and like, there's just like whole big ordeal, and it takes them the whole day just to go see their doctor for a couple, you know, 10 minutes to read a MRI they got 6 months ago that they could have just read it over the phone. But now that Medicare is, you know, and it's paying, I think it's great. I think it really, hopefully it sticks, and I hope it opens up the door. That kind of segues into my next question. So like, of your online, you said you have 50 athletes, like, so how many of them are rehab? How many of them are actually just purely performance? And like, how long do they usually work with you? Like, what does that lifespan look like? You know, and, where do you get your athletes from?
Well, it's a great question, because I am still a firm believer that rehab training is always a spectrum. I would say,
don't you go political on me.
I'm going to go to the point. But it is always difficult to quantify that number, because people float back and forth. Yeah. I do have a few athletes who are real high octane, and it becomes one of those things where you kind of got to like tap the screen and be like, hey, I told you to chill out.
Yep.
We're here because you wouldn't chill out. Yep. But of the 50 that I have right now, it's a little bit more than that. I'd say about 20 of them would be considered like, I can't train to the absolute way that I want to, or like, we always wonder, can I actually like increase performance? Can I stack performance on top of this person? Mm-hmm. They're probably not there yet. They're still trying to get back to baseline. Sure. The other 31, 32 of them are all performance. Most of them come, I'll tell you what, my local roots are pretty deep. So I would say 60 to 70% of them are relatively local, at least within the DMV region. Mm-hmm. And then the rest come from either word of mouth, or the Clinical Athlete podcast has been huge for me in regards to just getting my message out there and people interacting with it. So that would be probably my third, that and Instagram, but that's where they come from. And you know, I thoroughly enjoy it. And that's not just powerlifters. Yeah. I've got weightlifters in there. I've got strongman competitors in there.
Can you snatch?
It's a blast. I am.
can you front rack a barbell?
I used to have this great dream of being like a super total athlete. Yeah. And then it was a couple months ago. I looked at it was actually when I turned 36, and I was like, sweet, I'm a master's athlete now in USAW. Like, I could qualify. So I looked up the qualifying totals for the yeah. Could, I definitely could, if I didn't feel like my arms were going to snap off in a clip. Snatch wasn't bad. Like, I felt okay with snatching. It took a lot of warm up, but man,
you, get the front rack.
You've spoken about in the past how you feel that your shoulder mobility is an adaptation for your bench press.
Now, so there's actually a study on that, that there's a normal decrease in shoulder flexion overhead in like elite level bench pressers. So it's a sport adaptation that they are actually starting to see in some of the literature. There's not a ton of powerlifting literature.
Yeah.
But that is one of them. My other one is my other favorite one. Quinn sent me about contextual inference, where you you play darts while you bench press in between, and it actually artificially increases your RPE. So those are my two favorite papers right now. It's playing darts while bench pressing, and that bench press is a flexion reducer because of sport adaptation.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense of like, especially if you're like a true power focused bench presser, right, of you know, extension moments of the triceps and adduction and squeezing the lats, etc., creating, I mean, that makes a lot of sense. But on the flip side, if you would have been overhead squatting the entire time, you probably would be fine.
Oh yeah.
But would his 100%. Bench press be as heavy?
But I mean, it might be.
I don't think there's enough there.
No, definitely not.
But I'll tell you what, if I had been overhead squatting on a regular basis, I'd probably be much better off.
Yeah.
But
so when's the last time the bar touched the front of your shoulders? How close does it get? We got like 4 inches probably.
If it's just the bar, it has been a long time.
Yeah. I can't even touch my shoulders with just the bar. Don't worry.
It was last year. It was about this time last year. I helped Quinn out with a CWC in Tyson's Corner. And he used me as the example on how to build a front rack because I got underneath the bar. Yeah. And it was like at my nose. The whole crowd starts laughing at me. And I'm like, okay, I'm the butt of the joke now. That's great.
You mentioned RPE. Can I delve into a question about RPE?
Sure.
CJ, is that all right? See you. All right. So I know that
he's going to anyway.
Yeah, I'm going to ask anyway. John, I know that you speak with you're a precision athlete, right? Precision powerlifting systems.
Yes. Yeah. Kevin coaches.
And I know that Kevin, I don't know him well enough to call him Kev. I know that Kevin does a lot of dynamic systems theory, right?
Yes.
And that he's not very big on RPE for beginners because it is a skill, and that you need to train at a certain intensity before you're able to guess what your intensity is while you're training. And so for your clients online, your athletes online, do you use RPE for them as a start, or do you, like, how do you manage that? Like, do you use percentages? Do you use rep max? Do you use RPE? What system do you use?
So I do use RPE because I want them to be exposed to it as soon as I can. So using it being accurately used, this is probably the best way to put it. It being accurately used early on is probably slim. They're not going to be very good with it. However, if they don't get exposed to it, they're also not going to get exposures to that skill set. So I like to use it early on. The difficult part when it comes to coaching through that is that I can't tell somebody what their RPE is based off bar velocity or that sort of thing. So what I try to do is anchor it with some sort of rep max. And I'll do this early on, not like first 2 weeks early on, because most of them aren't prepared for that. Like, that would be a huge spike in workload and the Q to chronic work ratio debates aside, I really don't like to just take somebody and like throw them straight to the moon right off the jump street. But after, you know, 3-4 weeks where they've gotten a good amount of repetition in and they're starting to figure it out a little bit, I'll throw in, you know, a 5-6 rep max and say, okay, like, I want you to take what you said was an 8 a couple weeks ago for a set of 5, and I want to see you just do as many as you can. Some people are relatively accurate and they'll anchor that RPE relatively well, and they'll get like 6, and they're like, oh, okay, so we're pretty much on point. What you said was an 8 was probably closer to a 9. This is what it feels like. I've also seen people get 19 and you're like, okay, so when it starts to burn, that's not an 8 or 9. That's like, I'm warming up. So you get people and they realize that, and it's like, oh crap, I either have to go heavier, or if they're not comfortable with that, if they're relatively ranked beginners, I'll put in a variation with like a lot of tempo or relatively novel stimulus so that we'll still get that difficulty, because you add tempo to anything, it's going to artificially increase RPE. Sure. At a lower absolute intensity. You do a novel stimulus, same thing, because their degrees of freedom are still really low. They're just not able to do those things. They're like baby giraffes being born. So that's how I manage teaching RPE. And then you still have to occasionally anchor it, because you'll get like intermediate and advanced lifters that are like, it's an 8.5 and it's a 12. You're like, what are you doing? All right, yeah. Got to anchor this again. So it is a skill, but you know, some people, it takes a little bit longer for them to figure it out. And it is definitely a skill. I have also, in certain instances, and it depends on where the athlete is coming from, if they're a big time old school linear periodization where everything is percentages, I'll blend them. So like, okay, 65 to 70% for 5 to 6 reps should be about a 7. And, you know, then you make adjustments as those actual tendencies emerge over time.
Oh, I should have anchored this with what RPE is.
Rate of perceived exertion. How hard you think something is.
Yeah. 0 to 10 subjective rating on how difficult you think it is. But could also be connected to reps in reserve, in that an 8 out of 10 is, about two left in the tank, so to say.
Yeah. The only thing that I struggle with when it comes to RPE is it almost feels like it should be a 5-point scale, not a 10, because nobody ever even registers anything under a 5.
Yeah. Yep.
But everybody knows a 10. Go ahead, CJ. Right.
I do. I register under a 5 all the time, but we work in percentages. I don't. But if someone says, you know, I need a conversational effort, I'm all in. All in with some conversational efforts.
I got this. What's up, guys? How's the day?
That's funny. So I wanted to, you talked about some people claim it's an 8 or do a 5 rep, claim it's an 8 from 1 week, and then they do 19. Do you see a gender bias with that, as male to female, or obviously beginner to advanced is probably more accurate, but do you ever notice that women manage volume better than men, or vice versa?
To an extent, I'll say to an extent. I think women recover better, but so do lightweight men. So right. I do have some lighter weight men, and really a lot of it just comes down to the physiology involved and how much muscle mass they have and that sort of thing. I can say I've definitely started to notice in particular that there's almost like particular types of lifters. So Claire's eye and I talk about this all the time. Claire eats volume. Like she's incredible. You know, set to 10, super heavyweight, you know, 85% and just kill
it. Shout out to Bullseye Strength.
Yeah. Yeah. She's awesome. I can't do that. I've never been able to like survive those sorts of things. Even when I was lighter and I was like 190, 195 and not doing what I do now, I still thrived off singles, doubles and triples. And that's where that's like my happy zone. My injury rate is super low at that point. My progress is very consistent. I'm much more compliant, but when you have me start eating volume, I don't handle it well. So I can train at really, really high intensities for an extended period of time. And she can train at really, really high volumes for an extended period of time. My wife is right in the middle. Like we have to. So do I think there's a gender bias? Maybe because of just the fact that women are overall lighter athletes. And there's probably some hormonal mm-hmm. contribution there, you know, with the recovery effects that estrogen and progesterone and all those things have, they probably do tend to take more volume. But one thing I have found, I would say, and I don't want to sound ageist here, my older clients, because of a lack of exposure to strength training, tend to be much more conservative. So the 35 plus year old demographic, regardless of it's male or female, tend to be much more conservative with those numbers than a younger demographic.
Such an interesting topic to talk about, the aging strength athlete, because the convention is that you get injured because you're old. Whereas I think that people get injured because they spike without having trained for a significant period of years, and then thinking that they can just come back in and do whatever they want. And so I think it's a lack of a training adaptation rather than an inability to tolerate training at all.
You know? Well, there's definitely risk involved with like just jumping back into training.
Well, sure. Yeah.
But you know, there's a prevailing mindset in that generation that, I mean, look, it was like the cardio bunny. it was all run, step aerobics, you know, all these other types of physical activity. And I'm not bashing any of that stuff, but using weight was looked at as detrimental to your health. Yep. It stunted kids' growth. It, you know, made you slower. It made you immobile. It all these negative effects that people, you know, quantified with strength training and load. And that was pervasive in men and women, more so women, just because of the societal impact and what people view as like what they should or shouldn't do, which is complete bullshit too. That shouldn't be done. But I mean, I see it across the board. It's like, well, this feels heavy. And it's like, okay, this, you know, you got a 40-year-old guy. This feels heavy. All right, cool. Let me see how many you can do. 20 reps later. Yeah. Oh, all right. So let's put more weight on and let's try to do
that. That's the point. It's supposed to be heavy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's it. So.
Yeah, I think there's I think you hit, you know, a perceptual input there. So obviously I work with I'm gonna say obviously everyone listening, maybe people don't know me. I work with CrossFit athletes primarily, and a couple of weightlifters, and they're female weightlifters, the ones that I would say they're CrossFit athletes, but they're exceptional weightlifters, and all of them just eat volume. All of them. But again, I think there's like this, like, adaptation. So I've seen, I don't remember who it was, maybe Scotty or someone else posted something of due to almost like a muscle fiber design, genetically, women manage volume better. They manage close to 1 RM much better than most males do. And it's like the athletes that are just slightly less explosive. Like I personally am a great example of that. Like my 1 RM is horrendous, but I will take 85% for an hour without question. And I've done 80, like a real 84% for like 12 reps, like a true 84%, like a, like a new heavy 1 RM. And it's like, same thing with my weightlifting, fatigued weightlifting. I'm very comfortable, well over 90%, right at 100%. Like no matter how fresh I am, how strong I'm feeling, like it's like obviously like a 1 in a million shot. But it's like there's like it's really interesting. But I'm like definitely more of like the volume athlete. Like I'm not super explosive, and I don't have that like intensity focus. Like I really struggle to. Like just purely weightlift at like a high percentage, but like I'll manage like early phases, 15s, 12s at 70 and 75%. I feel the best. And that's like where I have like the most success from. But when we get like towards the end of a phase, towards like a testing, I almost always like creep up like a tendinopathy or something like that, or like an ache that I can't break. And
how many times did you train this week?
I didn't train yesterday. So 3. I'm doing fine. I don't train that hard. I don't train that often. Okay. I just train really
usually,
hard.
I mean, usually I'll text CJ during the day. He's like, "Oh, training number 3 today."
What the heck?
It's different. I'm not lifting every session, and sometimes my second session is bodybuilding. I'm in this garage, and you know, I'm like pretend there's a mirror there, and I'm staring at myself, so it's fine.
Got to take your shirt off so the neighbors to see. Yeah.
My training is much different. You know, like half of it's conditioning, 80% of it's conditioning. And now the whole CrossFit season is fucked. So we don't even know. So my coach is like, "Let's go to a weightlifting cycle." And I'm like, "Oh, great. I'm so excited to just
only CrossFit anymore. It's the Reebok games.
The next four, it won't be the Reebok games. It'll be the Iron Games."
Yeah.
Anyways.
So I wanted to ask another thing about dynamic systems theory, because is that similar to like a constraints led approach to training, or are those two things like together?
I would say they're together. Okay. The general kind of overview of dynamic system theory is being able to manipulate those constraints.
Right.
And it, you know, as coaches, this is a pretty big portion of, you know, the clinical athlete coaching course. As coaches, we can only control so many of those constraints. If you look at dynamic system theory, you have individual constraints. We can't really do a whole lot with that. Internal stress, how well they're sleeping, how well they're eating, the mindset that they come into the gym. Those are all constraints that the athlete puts on themselves. You know, we can give them mindset training. We can get them referred to, you know, a sports psychologist or whatever, but they still have to take ownership over that stuff. Environmental constraints are the next one. How hot it is in the gym, how loud the music is playing. Like there's again, certain things that we can control, but really, you know, how much can you really control? You get central air brought in, you turn the music down or whatever. But there's still limited control that you have. Then there's task constraints. That's what we can control. We can control a task constraint, and we can sit there and manipulate a pin squat as opposed to a competition squat to get a particular effect. I always look at this from traditional soccer coaching. So you have full field soccer where you got a lot of space. You can see the ball coming to you. You can see defenders coming to you. You can see the field. One of the things that soccer coaches have done for years is short field or small box soccer training to get a better first touch on the ball for their players, for them to play with their eyes up instead of staring down so that they respond and react faster. All they've done is take the task and constrain it into a smaller area to get a particular effect. And they're not sitting there going, okay, you got to, they're not cueing their athletes to like be faster, be quicker on the ball. No, I'm just going to make it so that the defender is 2 feet away from you instead of 10 feet away from you, and you're going to figure it out. It's the same thing with dynamic system theory with task constraints in powerlifting. If I see that you suck coming into the hole, or you can't create or maintain tension through there, then I'm going to constrain that task to make it so that you have to figure that out. One of my favorites for that is a pin squat. If you come down and you crash pins, you're done. It's error correction. Your brain's going to go, well, that didn't work. And you're going to have to figure out how to be successful there. You do a block of that and they come back, and now all of a sudden they learned how to create tension in the hole and they're squatting better. So it's the same thing. I think the constraints led approach just sounds way sexier. And it definitely is like easier to understand that statement than when you're like economical, dynamical systems. People are like, what is that?
So do you find that there's like, cause I'm trying to think of the specificity, right, of strength. And so I'm trying to figure out, when I think of the small field in soccer, I think of it like straying away from the task that you need to be specific for, which I guess would be a full field soccer. I guess, where's the difference between trying to just be as specific as possible for the task that you're trying to do, and like, how far away can you stray with the constraints before you're not being productive towards the task at hand?
My thought on
the overall task that you're trying to get to the goal.
Exactly. My thought on that is, first off, I've asked that question from a lot of people and nobody really knows. Because, so small field soccer, you're still playing soccer.
Right.
It's not line drills. It's not, you're not breaking portions of the game apart and working on how to pass or anything. You're still playing soccer. In a pin squat, if I set them to powerlifting depth, they're still squatting to the standard that's required, probably in the stance that is their competition stance. I've just added a constraint to the task to get a particular effect and change that portion of it. We don't stray away from it for so long that they regress in the actual main movement. But the other thing that I found, as long as you're able to meet the standards of the sport with something that's, you know, powerlifting, the squat's probably the most difficult one to meet their standard with, and you can do it with any type of foot width. You can do it with any type of hand grip width on the bar. As long as the bar's on your back and you can squat below parallel, you're pretty good. So wide stance high bar squat is viable there. A low bar narrow stance squat is viable there. So they're still squatting. They're still doing the actual task, especially from a performance standard. So if they're a performance athlete and I'm having them do pin squats or wide stance high bar squats or whatever it may be, as long as they can still meet the standard as the athlete that would pass in competition, I don't know. It's still specific to the actual task. The only time that changes is in like a rehab or where I'm taking the pins and putting them right at a range of motion threshold, or, you know, then obviously you're not going to meet standard because you've got patella tendinopathy that we have to work around, or, you know, you have to sit to a box you're not going to have a box in a powerlifting meet to sit to. So like those obviously are different, but you can still use it to change the competition task and watch that get better.
All right, cool.
That was a long answer.
No, I mean, I'm still trying to take information about different, because I see such a wide array of coaching styles and theories and different systems. And so it's good to hear this kind of stuff.
Well, the big thing for me, it does seem like a large dichotomy. You have individuals who, it's squat, bench, deadlift in your competition stance ad nauseum.
Sure.
And I'm not disagreeing with that in any way, shape, or form. That is going to work with particular athletes. There are other athletes that's not necessarily going to work for. And when it comes to, like, look at Westside compared to linear periodization, they all had really successful athletes. Some of them self-select to those particular methodologies because it just works for them. Conjugate worked for me for a good amount of time. Then it didn't. Like, okay, so I moved on to something else. Kevin and I are very flexible. It's one of the reasons why I've had people be like, why is Kevin Kane your coach? Kevin's my coach because we respect each other and he allows me a lot of free reign over what I do, but still holds my feet to the fire. So, I mean, that's what I need. But that dichotomy, I just don't think it exists in true practice. So it's tough. And part of that biggest problem with that is, like, if you look back at I have a book, I don't have it in front of me right now, but I think it's The Secrets of Culver City Westside Barbell, which is actually up in Ohio. I think it's up in Ohio.
Yeah.
But it's not the actual Westside Barbell. It's not Louis. It's Vincenello and all those guys. Man, they did a ton of weird stuff. Like, made up exercises. They tripped and fell over some really cool methods that, like, now we're going, oh, yeah, that works. And they did some stuff that just didn't work. And you look at their experimentation. If it was now, they would only post the cool shit on Instagram.
Sure.
So that's the other thing. It's like, well, I do it this way. Okay. So you're telling me you've never changed that person's exercise before? You've never used a variation?
Maybe did that book come with a flame beanie for you to squat in?
No. That was Chuck was way after that book.
Really?
Yeah. It's not an actual West Side Barbell book.
Oh, okay. I watched the Amazon or Netflix documentary recently, and I was just like, holy crap.
West Side versus the World?
Yeah, West Side versus the World. Such a good one.
Absolute savages in that place, man.
Yeah.
It's scary.
Whole nother world.
Dave Tate does a couple table talks that are awesome with stories about those guys. Oh, man.
Dude, talk about an interesting character, Dave. He's on a whole nother level. There's all those guys just cut from a whole nother cloth.
Yeah, I mean, you really have to be dedicated to get, like, American flag sleeve tattoos on your forearms. You know,
you really have to be that dedicated?
You have to be
that dedicated.
Yeah.
I mean, it's July 3rd, so.
I mean, I was going to ask John, when, talking about tattoo dedication, when are you going to get Rebuild Stronger on the neck?
On my neck?
On your neck.
I don't think I'm going to get it on my neck. No, I still have a whole sleeve I need to finish. I'm not going to do anything on my neck. And I have a wife that is phenomenal and incredibly supportive. The reason my beard is as long as it is because she doesn't want me to ever trim it.
Mm.
So, but neck and face tattoos, I think, are a deal breaker for her. I think that's a no. So I'm not going to go there.
That's funny.
CJ, go ahead. I know you had something you were going to
ask. Yeah, sorry about that.
I think we're talking about this dichotomy of, you know, specific to, you know, you guys are talking about powerlifting, but I think it very much reigns with weightlifting, CrossFit, gymnastics. There's there's so many successful directions of training that all of these sports have found. And I think it's not, you know, we talk about rehab's the same way, right? It's like, you know, oh, someone has back pain. Well, these exercises have worked for me every time. And this clinician, including myself, you know, resonates with these exercises at first. And then usually it probably works. Right. And, you know, for these apps, but the ones that it doesn't, you know, you have to stay flexible. But I mean, CrossFit and weightlifting are very much the same, right? There's, you know, there's lots of people who, you know, in weightlifting don't train the full lifts for long, long, long periods of time. Mm-hmm. Right. And then there's other schools of thought that you snatch, clean and jerk and back squat every day until your knees bleed. And, you know, they might be taking, you know, they might be getting some help, but it is what it is, you know. And then CrossFit, you have athletes that they aren't sports specific all year long. They just condition and they just get strong and they create single modality approaches to a multimodality sport. Until a couple weeks before competition and they're very successful, i.e. Matt Frazier. Like, that guy just beats himself into the ground with like assault bikes and rowing and no one knows what he does, but I'm pretty sure that's exactly what he does. And that's why he's so much better. And he just happens to be really fucking strong. You know, I mean, the guy doesn't jerk heavy for years, and then he jerked, you know, like 190 kilos from the blocks, like before the games last year. It was just like, oh, all right. Okay, sure. Why not? And
let me see what I got.
Then you have other athletes that do, like, I mean, massive CrossFit volume every day, 5 days a week, and they're successful too. And it's just, it's really interesting to see this performance side of all these different approaches to create the same result. And same with rehab. And I think it shows that it's really not us. It has so much more to do with the genetic makeup of the person in front of you and how they respond to what you're saying and what you're giving them, is probably so much more or less to do with you as the clinician or the coach and more to do with their inherent design.
Well, and I want to touch on that as well. The other portion of this, I think there are genetic kind of types that people self-select into. But the other thing to think about too here is the belief that athlete comes in with. So for me in particular, when it comes to my clientele, variation is a favorite modality of mine. Now, why is it a favorite modality of mine? Because I have people that are coming to me going, something's not working. I'm either in pain or I'm not seeing performance increases. Something's not working. So a lot of the times, if I bring a novel stimulus in, I can spark growth. Does that mean that I am highly variable with every single one of my athletes? No, I'm just not. I have programs and I have individuals right now that are only doing the competition lifts, even with nationals being canceled and everything like that. It just depends on what that person is in front of you, where their beliefs and where you can create buy-in. And then you create things around that. It's still all athlete client centered. And a lot of those things emerge over time. CJ's talking about people who can, that he's like really good at that 85%. I watched my wife the other day take 275, which is 90% of her one rep max for multiple sets of six on sumo deadlift. And then it's like, okay, 3 weeks earlier, it's like, just go for a new one rep max. And it was like, ugh, terrible. Just hated it. It's like 90% for sets of six across the board, just crushing them. Why? I don't know. Could we do that for a few months, just doing those for sets of six, five, six, seven, and then test again? Probably. Would it have gone up a ton? Probably not. But it's weird.
It is strange. I want to interject there and ask you a question. Do you feel the deadlift kind of breaks the mold of like working percentages compared to like the back squat?
Oh yeah.
Right. It's so strange. You're just like, 100%. Oh, it's like once you're going 95%, so many people. And I think this is for all, in my opinion, I think for just about everyone, obviously there's like, it varies, but if you break it off the ground once, most of the time unless you're like well over like a 1RM, like a true 1RM, it's going for multiple reps. Right. I think someone who really showed the craziness of it was down at, you know, at Hybrid. Like you'd watch Steffi, like she'd pull, like she'd get 500 going and then it just like wouldn't stop. And it was just like the first one would take, it would be like a 7 second rep. Right. And then the next one would be like a 3 second rep. Same thing with like Hayden. You see, and that guy can grind out anything in the world. Like he's just on a whole other world. He's weird. I watched him. I was at Seoul when they were there. And I watched him squat 600 and I watched him go down and elevate, descend in the same squat because he was grinding so hard and still make it. I mean, like inches, not like a pause and like a sticking point. Like this guy was shaking. The weights were clanging and he was like, and then just came back up. And I was like, I quit. I think I squatted like 300 next to him that day. And I was like, you know what? I'm just going to, I'm going to say, stick with CrossFit.
But kilos, it, wow, man.
Yeah. But yeah, the deadlift, I think it's, you know, how have you seen that? It's really strange. Like what have you seen with that as far as like programming percentages, is that, or okay. RPE, does that change? Like, how does that change based on the lift itself? And why do you think it is?
I have seen that. I've seen it across the board. One of my favorite variations on deadlift to teach just maintaining position is like a 1+1 or a 1+2, where you do a full lift, you come down almost to the ground and you come back up with it. So it's one plus partials. And you'll see, I mean, I can handle a 1+2 at like 95% of my one rep max. As long as I get the first one, I just off the ground, like maybe an inch off the ground. Spicy. And yeah, it's spicy as hell. Especially if you actually have people do multiple reps of that. Like, I'll have people start with 3x1+2 and they're just like, why am I doing deadlift cardio? Because you're going to get in a better position.
Deadlift cardio. You guys are funny. Cardio comments.
9 reps in a single set. It sounds terrible.
Oh, crazy.
But
I'm programming over 6, bro.
So can you not count that high, or are you just not comfortable with it? So I think I've definitely seen that happen, especially when you see those grinder first reps, and then all of a sudden it's like 2, 3, 4, 5 get knocked down right after it. I think a lot of it has to do with two particular things. A, there's no benefit of the stretch reflex in the initial pull. We have experimented with like small jumps prior to it. I've seen with conventional deadlift in a few of my athletes, give them a little bit more pop off the ground. Do I think that's from the jump, or do I think it's a thought interruption where they don't second guess what they're about to do? I don't know. I can't tell you. Cause I think the other thing is confidence. I think once that thing is moving, it's like, okay, well, I got it now. Right. I'm just going to keep going.
Yeah.
There's something about a deadlift. When a bar is on your back or in your hands or over your head, it can kill you. You can bail at any point in time on a deadlift.
Yeah.
Just let it go. So sure. You always have an out too. Like, you grind out a squat, because if you don't, you better have somebody come get this damn
constraint thing off. Led approach.
Yeah.
Squat or die.
Squat or die. With deadlift, you can be halfway up and go, boys. Man, this is getting hard. I'm just going to put it down. So I think there's a lot of psychological constraints to it, but also that lack of stretch reflex, that lack of,
I think that's
preloading in the system prior to being able to pull it off. And then how often, I'm a big fan of like a full reset at the bottom where you come down, you actually like not fully relax, but you let the bar settle.
Right.
If you come down and you've got bumper plates on and you slam it to the ground and start pulling again, like, I mean, in certain instances, yeah, like in powerlifting, I can't have that happen. With CrossFit athletes, absolutely, it's touch and go. It's to the standard of their sport. It has to touch. You get a rep if it touches. Touch it. Throw it on the ground. Bang. I don't care if they're gonna let you do it. Do it. Strongman's the same way. You can take a strongman axle and literally bounce that thing off the ground and keep going in a deadlift suit. It's the craziest thing in the world.
Yeah.
But for powerlifting, I like to settle, and it also gets rid of that, just that little bit of stretch reflex, and it gets really hard.
Yep. Agreed. I think that's a really good point. I think you kind of, I never like to create a physiological answer 100% to anything, but that's gotta be pretty close. Right. I think that's gotta be, definitely there's like a priming of the system, a stretch reflex of like, like really getting the muscle spindles and GTOs like firing and primed, going down for that second rep. That's really cool. I like the pluses. I think that's something that I might implement. A lot of my athletes struggle with any type of deadlift volume. They all get really sore, but they'll clean like 30 pounds less than that for reps. And I'm like, I don't understand you guys. It's just like, it's just the movement. It's just like, it's strange. Cool. That's interesting. I like that. I like that reasoning. And I really like that, that exercise selection.
Yeah. Cool. And, how much do you guys listen to like Chris Duffin?
Zero.
Yeah. I mean, in the day, one of my good friends is a good friend of his. He's a strength coach for the special forces now, or he's a performance guy for special forces now. But outside of like when he sends me stuff, that Chris, that guy's a psychopath. He's nuts.
He is mega crazy. He is mega crazy. He says wild stuff.
Yeah,
he does. There's one thing he says about the deadlift that is 100% true, is if you slow people down on their eccentric, they find better start positions.
Oh, yeah. 100%.
You know what I mean? Like, it works. Now, he has also said some absolutely wild stuff. I think everybody has said something of value at some point. But, you know, that's I always attribute it to him when I do, you know, slower eccentric deadlift stuff, because – you know, he's the one that touts that so much, is slow eccentric to get a better start position or maintain better positions. And a lot of the times when we start talking about positional work, it's just how much time you spend there to get a benefit.
Yeah, that's what I one of the things that I've moved to as far as like training with everyone, right? Almost everyone goes from A to B really pretty effectively, right? Creating force is usually never, especially in weightlifting, right? It's like, getting the bar to move vertical is usually not a problem for most people, right? It's having a good A, having a good B, and then being really, really, really strong in those positions. And I've noticed that from a longevity standpoint, managing volume and intensity, when you add pauses and time under tensions at the beginning, at the end of reps, you know, the joints respond a lot better, you know, soreness responds a lot better. And then they just get a lot better, right? Like catching a snatch is not an easy thing. And, you know, or a front rack.
You getting called out.
Bar got to get on my shoulders. But when you spend time there and you just really, really hone in on those positions, they just naturally get better by time under tension. And that's one thing that I've implemented in all of my, especially my rehab athletes, is like a primary portion of training. It's just like, you know, people have pain, you know, pressing from to overhead. It's like, well, let's just be overhead until this pain starts to just absolve on its own. And then all of a sudden their overhead position is just fantastic. Right. So anyways.
Well, and then they also sit there and they can feel like they're actually training.
Right. Exactly.
Like it's, that's the big thing. And, you know, people make fun of like our biases when it comes to like, I want people to look like they're training. But one of the reasons I want them to look like they're training is because they come in, they have this expectation when they meet a clinician that we're just going to shut them down and be like, well, okay, well, here's a band and your shoulder hurts. So you're just going to do these external rotations until like your face turns blue and the band disintegrates. And then maybe you'll touch a barbell again. No, I want you, let's use a barbell. If we can get it overhead comfortably and explore some positions that are tolerable for you, not even pain-free, just tolerable. And we start something that looks like training, it, mentally, the mindset there is so much better for the athlete than ticky-tack exercises they're not going to do.
Right. Agreed. So that kind of opens up another question that I had, this whole like how to define the difference between an AT and a PT besides the degree itself. So if you work with athletes that are injured, like what is the, you know, where do you live? What state are you in?
Maryland.
Okay. Where do you live? Where do you live in Maryland?
Southern Maryland, south of DC.
Oh, okay. I go to North Baltimore a lot, actually. Anyways.
Oh my God! Can we all have a lift together? I'll drive over.
Oh yeah, for sure. If I'm in Baltimore, yeah, I'll probably be in Baltimore in the fall. Anyways, what was I saying? Oh, so how do you? You know, like so. My rudimentary knowledge is like an athletic trainer, you know, needs a licensed physician to oversee, like, how do you eval, how do you treat people? You know, does the cash influence have a lot to do with like what you're allowed to do or, the gray line? What's your, how does Frank call it? Your risk profile. Yeah. That was my favorite thing. And I was like, I was like, I'm gambling, baby. We gambling always.
All day.
TJ's the guy that flips the cops off as he drives.
I was so excited. When he said that, I was like, I resonated with so much early on in that course of like, you know, like the Practice Act and like what it can and can't do and how great. Anyways, so talk to us about that. And I think that'll kind of close us out of like, you know, like how does that influence your practice? Like, what is that? what does that look like? Like, are you, you know, obviously you're doing identical things that me and Joe are, right? I mean, like, it's not, you know, we're not going to try and sugarcoat it and say you're not, because you are. Like, how does that work from a legality standpoint? Man, that's a big old wasp in my garage.
And then I have a follow-up at the end of that question too.
He's just, I was like, what is CJ staring at? It looks like someone's trying to kill him all of a sudden. Yeah. It's a wasp.
Sorry.
Oh no, it's fine. So it is a very complex question. I still have a supervising physician. I still have certain things written in my eval and treat that are very specific to what I do. The big issue when it comes to the online space, and we start talking about your risk profile, is I don't put hands on people. I don't do any type of manual treatment. I don't do any real diagnosis. It's typically just counseling. So we're on the phone, we talk a little bit, we modify training, and then they move forward. Even in a rehab setting, I'm not taking post-op ACLRs. I'm not doing any of this really complex stuff that may have a protocol attached to it or a diagnostic portion attached to it. Most of the time, it's just troubleshooting training for people, which a lot of the times just looks like strength and conditioning and performance. There are times where if I'm going, okay, and this is where that risk profile comes in. There are times where I'm like, all right, modifying training is no longer viable here. We're not able to do the things that we need to be able to do. We're going to punt. And I find them a local practitioner that they can actually go and physically see. So down in North Carolina, I've got a couple athletes. They all go see Zach Long. So Zach will, you know, see my athlete. I get an email from him. I get a message from them. And basically Zach says, okay, this is what we're going to do. This is what we're looking at training wise. And we kind of coordinate that whole thing together. And then once they start feeling better, I take the ball and run with it again, unless, you know, something else comes up. That method for me has been incredibly effective, because there are times where atypical responses to training or intervention creep up. And I'm like, this is not right. This doesn't make any sense. And I refer to a GP, or I refer to, you know, a physician or an ortho, and you find out that this athlete has psoriatic arthritis and there's nothing we would have been able to do anyway. So I punt more often than not to keep my ass safe. Because if you were to look at what I do, yes, like I have individuals who are injured, who are going through pain and that sort of thing, but it's still being handled in a strength and conditioning type of lens. I just have a background that's very specific towards that type of management. If there is any a time where I'm like, this person needs a step up outside of just like talking to someone and figuring out training, that's when I want them to see somebody actually like physically in person. And I just become the referral hub for that sort of thing. Does that answer your question?
How do you prime your athletes before sending them to another clinician, if at all?
How do I prime them?
Yeah. Like, hey, you know, take what they're saying with a grain of salt, or, you know, imaging is X, Y, and Z with symptoms, or is there any sort of like a pre speech that you give them, or you just send them and see what happens?
Man, that's a great question. Most of the time we've already had those conversations.
Okay.
You know, if I have an individual that's been struggling with a particular ailment or we have to continue to modify for training, those are typically conversations we've already had. The complexity of pain, you know, MRI reporting, imaging, you get that a lot. You have an athlete that has knee pain going up or down the steps for a couple weeks, and they're you're modifying training a little bit, and the first thing they want to do is, I want to go to the doctor and see what's wrong. Well,
yeah.
In reality, like, you guys have been through this plenty of times. How many times is that MRI going to come back and tell you what's actually going on?
Yeah, sure. It shows that you're a biological organism.
Yeah. And so that conversation typically has already happened. Where I prime them when it comes to especially seeing like a physician or another practitioner is I prime them to be advocates for their own health when they're there, ask questions, be involved in the process. In some instances, if they have to be a little aggressive and come across and say, look, this is what I want to do. And if somebody looks at you and says, well, maybe you should stop, go somewhere else. And then like, you know, from certain cases, I've got athletes in Texas that live in the middle of nowhere. We find the best that we can down there.
Sure.
And I mean, there's a couple times where they've been like, you do what? Why would you do that?
Yeah. It's just such a fine line to walk between trying to save face with the medical world and not create a like a mistrust with physicians, but also being like, hey, you know, a lot of them say things that might not be accurate. And all three of us know that, you can't unring the bell and you can't stuff the toothpaste back in the tube. And so I've always had a little bit of difficulty trying to walk that line between being like, yeah, don't listen to anything that they say. And also they probably know a lot more than we give them credit for. And a lot more than we do on certain things. And so it's always a fine line to walk when I have people go to different providers.
So have you gotten or explored any into motivational interviewing?
Yeah, I have a general gist of it, you know, kind of a meet. I don't have a specific definition for it, but a meet them where they're at sort of thing.
There's
if I recall correctly.
Motivational interviewing for nutrition and fitness counseling book. I'll send you guys the like a screenshot of it or something. But one of the things that I've found really effective lately is when you talk about unringing that bell, and one of the hardest things, and I absolutely hate it, you have an athlete go see a physician or go see another provider and they come back and there's conflicting information. What I've said and what this person has said. And what it does is it creates ambivalence. It's okay. So I have hip pain and, you know, we look at it and not a lack of range of motion. You're able to hit standard. It's probably just a training effect. It's probably something normal. You also haven't been sleeping or haven't, your nutrition's off or all these other things. They go and see a physician and their physician tells them that there's just something wrong with their hips. You know, they're aligned.
Bone on bone.
Oh yeah. Whatever it is that you want to say. So my strategy when it comes to that is taking a page out of motivational interviewing and being like, okay, so the physician told you that just structurally your hips are misaligned and not in the right places. If that's the case, why now?
Right.
So all I do is highlight that ambivalence and be like, okay, mm-hmm. So we've trained for 2 years. You've been kicking ass for 2 years. You used to be a competitive athlete. Why now? If there was something structurally wrong with them like that, you're 30 something years old. Like, why now? Why not in your 20s? Why not when you were 16 and in high school playing three different sports? Why now? And then they're like, oh, I don't know. Probably, you know, do you feel as though you know your body better than anybody else? Do you feel as though you're just not adapting well because, you know, the body's highly adaptable? Or do you think this is just some specter that's been waiting to jump on your back for 30 years? And then they're like, oh.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Helping them to the answer that you think is appropriate.
Yeah.
I have one last question before we wrap this up. Cool.
I got plenty of time. Right. I don't know about TJ. He wants to work out.
I mean, he's a
he wants to kill that wasp is what he wants to do.
Yeah, it's gone. I can't find it. I'm super nervous. I just want my anxiety to the roof right now.
I hope we find it while we're watching you on video. So as an AT and as an advocate for the profession, what are your thoughts on the possible advancement to a doctorate of athletic training in the career field?
Mm.
The DAT, the DAT.
Ooh, that sounds pretty dope. Just kidding. No, maybe
I mean,
not.
I'll
facial expression.
Yeah. So I'll preface this by saying a lot of people think that physical therapists shouldn't have gone to DPT based on the debt incurred. Is it incurred? The debt incurred.
Debt incurred,
just because people are like, yeah, they're doctors now, so we can charge them for a 7-year degree or a 6-year degree with information that, I mean, we probably don't use almost any of it except for anatomy and physiology. What are your thoughts on the athletic training population? Because I know that the occupational therapy career field has already started the doctor program, because I've worked with one in the past.
So nobody likes my answer in my field. Nobody likes my answer,
which is,
I think it makes the most practical sense, but nobody likes it. So little background. Athletic training and physical therapy have been fighting each other since the golden age of all things. Since AT started, PT has been fighting them. When it's come to licensure, the ability to charge insurance with athletic training, still can't do, and limiting each other's scope as much as possible. I understand that contention 100%. I understand athletic trainers would pose a threat, especially if before, when an MPT was required, you guys shifted to a DPT. All we still needed was a bachelor's degree. So especially like the neuro components, and the physical therapy has a much more extensive focused education towards general physical therapy. Athletic trainers are all ortho, right? It's all ortho, and it's mostly athletic ortho. I think, oh boy, here it comes. I think athletic training should be a specialty within physical therapy education.
Hot take.
I think it should be the last year of your DPT program. If you want to be an AT, that should be the sports med track in physical therapy. And the reason that is because if you look at the profession of athletic training, it's getting choked out. It's confusing to the consumer, because people have a really hard time telling the difference between an athletic trainer and a physical therapist. Just as a consumer, like we can argue about it all the time. The confusion comes from actual consumers. We haven't done enough as a profession to differentiate ourselves from personal trainers, because we still have this 20-year long figure out what the hell our name is campaign. Because athletic trainers, people are like, well, what is that? Do you work at a gym? Do you work where you work? No, we work with athletes after injury and concussion and all that stuff. Athletic training as a profession is insanely valuable. It's one of, I think, especially for high school athletes and younger athletes, one of the most valuable exposures to healthcare they'll ever have, because it's so accessible. The problem is that people don't know what it is. The education for it, I think, is subpar. And at this point in the marketplace, and this is the last portion of this, we're all hired by PTs anyway. If you work in a hospital, your supervisor is a physical therapist. If you work in a clinic and you're an outpatient, or you do outreach to schools, you're typically hired by a PT firm. Unless you're in a college, in the university setting, most of them are not supervised by other athletic trainers. So,
but then, so in my, the question is, for the pro in college, the highest level, so you have your Power Five and your pros, aren't most of them PT ATs?
Yeah.
Like almost all of them are, because they can pay them less. And they fill two voids.
They fill two voids.
And so that's like, one of my friends was like, yeah, I want to do PT for a pro team. I'm like, you can't, like, you're not an AT. They won't, like, you won't get hired. Cause then they need to, you don't, unless you go and you get the concussion, like, certs, right. And like the on-field management, which is literally at least a full year of continuing ed. Right. Cause like, we don't get any on-field training. We don't give any found it. We don't get any acute care management as far as true acute care management as far as injury. And so there's this big disconnect, and it's like, okay, well, this PT is in this role in this pro and sports team, but he can't do 40% of what we need him to do, which is like on-field management. So you have this dual profession now.
My university had a, you could either do a 6-year PT degree or you could do a 7-year ATPT degree. Do you think that that's a good mix?
I mean, I don't know if it necessarily needs to be that long.
Well, but, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Not make it that long. God,
yeah.
It's so long. Why are you going to school?
I'll say this. The undergrad was separate from the grad school. And so I think the undergrad was not.
I see no problem with, like, at Salisbury, your first year in school, you did prerequisites and you had to apply to the program within the school. So, I mean, that made it pretty selective in and of itself, but I see no problem with it being like 1 year of just general undergrad work, 3 years of focused undergraduate work where you come out with your AT,
right?
Or actually 2.5 years, and you start before your actual graduation in PT specific courses where you also have to apply again and get out in 6 years with a DPT AT.
Yeah, right. I agree. I think that's appropriate.
Well, yeah. And then the other thing too, there's so many advanced specializations. You guys have OCS, you have the SES, you have all these other things. Why not just have AT, not even just coming out as a DPT AT, but like that's your sports specialist.
Yeah.
And you actually have like, you're talking about debt incurred. Well, let's make it valuable.
Sure.
Yeah.
Let's make it valuable.
So you heard it here first. Dissolve the athletic training career field. Thank you, John.
I mean, I would absorb, not dissolve. And it's not popular because people want, they continue to want AT and PT separate. And I just don't think as a market, it just doesn't. I don't see the efficacy.
At least in the ortho field, I think in the ortho field, it doesn't really make a lot of sense. Obviously, like you said, the neuro specialties and things like that, I think it can still have its separate paths. But if you want to be ortho, even not athletic, like population, like just ortho in general, I think it would behoove you to have this like dual training of like peer acute management. And that's like where the biggest difference is that I found is like this on-field management, and like the higher level athlete, management. Cause you know, me and Joe, we're obviously peak physical athletes, but we, our schooling has taught us didn't teach us how to manage very, very athletic people like that. We didn't go through any of that. You want to know what my exercise was in school? Legit. My pulmonary teacher who did all my geriatrics. She was, GCS. Taught us some like calf raises at the kitchen sink and some like legit quarter squats. That was it. That was the extent of like actual exercises learned in school. And I remember the class too. And I was like, wow, well, this was great. This was eye opening.
So well, John, I mean, will you go back and get your doctorate?
Yeah. I've played with it. No,
no, no, no way. You're 6. No, that would be, debt incurred, man. Debt incurred. 100%.
Before?
I would yell at you.
Oh, sure. My gosh. But, well, I had plenty of people actually yell at me. This is a funny story. You actually mentioned that. Before I got out of clinic and was like, I'm going to scale up Rebuild Stronger, I thought to myself, well, maybe I should just go back and get my DPT. Like, maybe I should just go, like, do it. For this same exact conversation. Because it's massively uncomfortable to be the only AT in the room. And I am always the only AT in the room.
Yeah, for sure.
Like in clinical athlete, people are like, wait, you have an AT on the podcast? Yes, apparently. It's this guy. Yeah. It's the meathead.
This guy.
That's awesome.
That's all right. It's cool. But hey, you stand out.
I remember calling Quinn, calling Jake Manley, and both of them being like, what the fuck is the matter with you? Both of them were like, no, why would you do that? No, don't, no. That's ridiculous. Don't do that.
Oh, dude.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Panic attack.
Yeah.
All right. Don't go pay $120,000 to get a degree.
On the low end.
Yeah. So,
yeah.
I don't know. That it's always that. It always goes back to your risk profile. What are you willing to do?
Agreed.
And for me,
I agree.
Most of it's strength conditioning, so. I'm sticking to it.
Exactly. Cool. All right, guys. Well, I think that's our time for today. Thanks for hopping on. John, where can we find all of your NIS at? Give us your Instagram and
most and things. I'm most active on Instagram. So that's Rebuild Stronger Online on my Instagram. You can email me at any time if you have questions. I'm pretty much an open book, as obvious from this. So rebuildstrongeronline@gmail is a great place. And then you can always find me on the Clinical Athlete Forum trolling people.
Perfect. That's where I would prefer to find you. Awesome. Thank you for listening. This was John Flagg, and we are signing off on episode 1 of the Golden Nuggets podcast.
Golden Nuggets. Love it.